constant honing. Lying flat behind a boulder 100 meters up the rocky slope, an Afghan teenager put down his AK-47 and peeked around the rock. He could see the big mottled green helicopter. He knew it only as Shaitan Arba. On the ground, its stationary rotors drooping with their own weight. He saw a circle of figures beneath the billowing canopy. Over the faint roar of the river and the wind in the rocks, the boy heard another sound from the valley floor, a shrill keening, a young woman's screams which went on and on. The boy uttered a prayer and slipped away. He knew there was something down there that was more terrifying than just infidel Russians. Maturin got his nickname that day from his men, at least the ones who could continue watching him use his knife. Khyber looked down at Dominika with his poached egg eye, took his hand off her foot and said, "Get dressed." She had an appointment with Uncle Vanya. Ustinov's rustic pâté. Caramelized chicken livers, pancetta and garlic, then deglaze pan with brandy. Hand-chopped mixture with parsley, capers, shallots, lemon zest, lemon juice, and olive oil into a coarse texture. Add additional olive oil. Serve on toast with lemon. Chapter 5. After the murder of Ustinov, Uncle Vanya had summoned Dominika to Yasenyevo. She was escorted to the executive elevator bank of SVR headquarters. The SVR shield of star and globe hung inside the elevator. Dominika still had a copper taste in her mouth, still felt the slippery sensation of Ustinov's blood on her body. For a week she fought down the recurring horror, tried vainly to sleep, resisted the crawly impulse to physically slough the skin off her breasts and belly. The nightmares had faded, but now she was sick and depressed and livid at the way she had been manipulated. Then Uncle Vanya had sent for her. She had never been to Yasenyevo, inside SVR headquarters, much less on the executive fourth floor. It was deathly still. No sound came from any of the closed doors visible down the corridors. She was walked past airbrushed official portraits, each one discreetly spotlighted, of former KGB directors lining one side of the long, red-carpeted hallway that led from the elevator to the executive suite. Andropov, Fedorchuk, Chebrikov, Khrushchev. Berlin, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Afghanistan. On the opposite wall hung the portraits of the new leadership of SVR. Primakov, Trubnikov, Lebedev, Fradkov. Chechnya, Georgia, Ukraine. Were they all in heaven or hell? The old boy's eyes followed her as she walked down the hall. To the right were the imposing doors of the director's office. To the left, identical doors led to the first deputy director's office. Dominika was shown in. Uncle Vanya sat behind a large desk of polished, light-colored wood. A heavy piece of glass covered the top of the desk. Apart from a red leather blotter in front of him, the desk was clean. A bank of white telephones squatted on the credenza behind the desk. The large office, carpeted in a deep blue, had a comfortable couch and chairs at the opposite end, next to three picture windows that had a magnificent view of the pine forest. It was a brilliant winter day, and sunlight streamed into the office. Vanya motioned Dominika to take a seat. He looked at her closely. She was wearing a dark blue skirt and crisp white shirt, nipped at the waist by a narrow black belt. She looked as beautiful as ever, but she had dark circles under her eyes and was noticeably pale. Using her on the Ustinov thing had been an inspired move. Too bad the experience for her had been so extreme. It was her bad luck that the urgent order from the Kremlin to settle Ustinov's hash had coincided with her departure from ballet school and her father's death. Neither of them spoke. According to the report, she had performed creditably, had charmed the pants off Ustinov, so much so that he had dismissed his security detail and thus given Maturin the opening to get to the target. Even though she had not had hysterics, he gathered it had been a little rough for her. Mathurin was a bit much for the uninitiated. She would get over all that. "Dominique, I commend you on your excellent performance in the recent operation," said Vanya. He looked evenly at his niece from across the desk. "I know it must have been difficult, a shock." He leaned forward. "It's over now. You can forget the unpleasantness. Of course, I don't have to tell you about your duty, your responsibility, never to mention this to anyone ever." Her mother had told her to always be careful around him, but she was wound up. Throat tightening, Dominika looked at the yellow haze around him. Her voice quavered. "You say unpleasantness. I watched a man murdered, a foot from my face. We were naked. He was on top of me, as you well know. I was covered in his blood. My hair was matted with it. I can still smell it." She saw her uncle's eyes and felt his unease. "Be careful," she thought. There was an undercurrent of anger there, too. Her voice soft again. "Just a little favor, a simple matter. You said I'd be helping you out." She smiled. "He must have really done something, that you had to kill him." Damned impertinence. Vanya was not about to discuss politics, nor Putin's toxic narcissism, nor the necessity of making an example of Ustinov for the benefit of the other kulaks. No, he had summoned his niece for two reasons. He wanted to assess her state of mind, to judge whether she could keep her mouth shut, whether she could put the incident behind her, recover from her trauma. And depending on the answer to the first question, he would have to consider two further options. If Dominika rose from her chair unhinged and refusing to listen, she could not leave the headquarters building alive. Mathurin would solve the problem. Dominika might not realize it, but she was an eyewitness to a political assassination that Putin's enemies would love to document for the world. If that happened, he, Igorov, would be forfeit. Right now, certain state organs were covering Ustinov's death as a grisly murder at the hands of a business rival. Everyone knew the truth. This had been expected. But if his 25-year-old niece with Fabergé blue eyes and a 95C bosom subsequently stood up and told what she had seen, and from what vantage point, the opposition press would never stop. If, however, she seemed under control, he would take steps to ensure her continued discretion. His political well-being hinged on her future good behavior. He had already decided that he would accomplish this by bringing her inside, into the service under the permanent discipline and supervision of the center. There would be no difficulty doing so. A job in records in the archives. She would be accounted for, engaged in training, learning procedures and regulations. They could keep an eye on her. Depending on her performance, he did not expect much, she could be given a clerical job in one of the departments, an ornament in the outer office of some general. Later, perhaps, she could be assigned abroad, buried in a residentura in Africa or Latin America. After 5 years, by that time the directorship would be his, she could even be cashiered for cause and kicked out. Vanya spoke softly. "Niece, it is your duty to be always loyal, to do your utmost to serve your country. There is no question of your discretion. It is absolutely required of you. Is this going to be a problem between us?" Vanya looked at Dominika steadily as he knocked the ash off the end of his cigarette. It was the exact moment where the next part of her life would be decided. The usual yellow halo around Vanya's head had grown darker, as if suffused with blood, and the timbre of his voice had changed, taken on an edge. In a telepathic flash, Dominika realized it, remembered her mother's whispers. "Zaladenyet," she thought, summoning control. "Become ice." She looked up at her uncle, whom she was beginning to detest, and also beginning to fear. Their eyes met. "You can depend on my discretion," she said woodenly. "I knew I could," said Vanya. She was a smart girl. He could see her instincts at play. She had sense. Now to put a cube of sugar on the teaspoon. "And because you have performed so well, I have a proposal. He leaned back in his chair and lit another cigarette. I'm offering you a starting position as a staff member of the service. I want you to join me in our work here. Dominika willed herself to remain expressionless and was satisfied watching Vanya's eyes searching her face for a reaction. In the service, she said. I've never considered it. This would be a fine opportunity for you right now. Steady employment, start accumulating a pension. If you belong to the service, I can continue to guarantee your mother can keep her apartment. Besides, what else would you do? Look for a job as, what, a dance instructor? He crossed his hands on his desk. Dominika mentally marked the spot on Uncle Vanya's shirt where she would plunge the pencil lying on his desk. She lowered her eyes and kept her voice calm. Helping mother would be important, she said. Vanya made an of course gesture with his hand. It would be strange to work here, she added. Not so strange, said Vanya, and we could work together. The words floated above his head, changing color with the sunlight outside. Of course, thought Dominika. A staff recruit would work closely every day with the deputy director. What sorts of duties would I be assigned? Said Dominika. She knew enough already to guess the answer. You would have to begin at the entry level, of course, said Vanya. But all the functions of the service satisfy a critical need. Records, research, archives. An intelligence organization survives or perishes on how it manages information. Of course, they wanted her buried in the third sub-basement. I'm not sure I know about such duties, Uncle, said Dominika. I don't think I would do well. Vanya hid his irritation. He really had only two choices with this Venus de Milo. Maturin could dispose of her before lunch, or he could get her into the service under control. The middle ground was unacceptable. She couldn't be left walking around Moscow, resentment growing, perhaps thinking of getting even. Sukin Sin. I'm sure you would learn quickly. It's quite important work, Vanya said. Now he was reduced to trying to convince this silly twit. I do think I would have an interest in another part of the service, said Dominika. Vanya peered over the desk at her hands clasped and motionless. She was still sitting with a straight back, head erect, stricken. Vanya said nothing, waited. I would like to be admitted to the Foreign Intelligence Academy as a candidate trainee. The Academy? The AVR, said Vanya slowly. You want to be an intelligence officer? In the service? Yes, I think I would do well, said Dominika. You yourself said I performed satisfactorily with Ustinov and gaining his trust. Raising Ustinov made the point. Vanya lit his third cigarette in as many minutes. Not counting the women in support functions, there had been two, perhaps three, women in the first chief directorate in the old KGB, and one of them was an old battle axe in the Presidium. None had ever been admitted to the old KGB higher school, or to the Andropov Institute, or to the current AVR. The only women involved in field operations were the co-opted wives of Residenturi officers and the Vorobyei, the trained sparrows who seduced recruitment targets. But in 30 seconds, Vanya Igorov made a lightning calculation. As a candidate in AVR, his niece would be under even more stringent control. Her performance, attitude, and physical whereabouts for the foreseeable future would be constantly monitored. She would be physically out of Moscow for long periods of time. If she strayed and was tempted to open her mouth, she would fall under the disciplinary jurisdiction of the service. Her dismissal, even imprisonment, would be a matter of a stroke of the pen. More broadly, he could generate some political profit from putting her name forward as a candidate for the Academy. He would be the high-minded deputy director who for the first time selected a woman, athletic, educated, fluent in languages, for formal training in the modern SVR. Bosses in the Kremlin would see the public relations benefits. From across the desk, Dominika saw his face, followed his calculations. Now would come the reluctant agreement, the inevitable stern warnings. You're asking a lot, Vanya said. There's an entrance examination, a high refusal rate, then long training quite rigorous. He swiveled in his chair to look out the picture window, considering. He had made up his mind. "Are you prepared to commit yourself to this path?" he asked. Dominica nodded. She wasn't absolutely sure, of course, but it would be a challenge, and that appealed to her. She was also loyal. She loved her country. She knew she wanted to try to join one of the premier organizations in Russia, perhaps, she thought, even to contribute. The Ustinov killing had repulsed her, but it had also shown her, in the space of an evening, that she could handle secret work, that she had the brains and the courage and the fortitude. There was something else, she knew, something ill-defined, something accumulating in her breast. They had used her. Now she wanted to intrude into their world, these domovladelci, these landlords who abused the system and its people. She wondered what her father would think. "I will consider it," said Vanya, swiveling back to look at her. "If I decide to submit your name, and if you are selected, your performance in the AVR will be a reflection on me, on the whole family. You realize that, do you not?" Charming. His concern for her and the family had not kept him from throwing her at Ustinov. She almost said, "I'll be sure to preserve your reputation," but she pushed the anger back down and instead nodded again, more sure now about wanting the academy. Vanya stood up. "Why don't you go downstairs and have lunch? I will tell you my decision this afternoon." He would have to clear it with a director, gentle persuasion, and the director of training would have to be browbeaten, a pleasure. But Dominika's place would be reserved, and the thing would be done, and his problem with her would be solved. When she left, Vanya picked up the phone and spoke briefly into it. Dominika was escorted back down the hallway to the elevator. The former directors all looked as if they had faint smiles on their faces. In the sprawling cafeteria, Dominika ordered the Kotlyeta Pokievsky, a hard roll and a bottle of mineral water. The cafeteria was moderately crowded, and Dominika had to search for an empty seat. She found a table where two middle-aged women were sitting at the other end. They looked at the beautiful young girl with the tired eyes and the visitor's badge, but said nothing. Dominika began eating. The chicken was lightly breaded, golden brown, and delicious. A trickle of butter came from the rolled-up cutlet. There was the rich taste of garlic and tarragon. The cutlet morphed into Ustinov's throat, and the butter sauce turned vermilion. She put down her knife and fork with trembling hands. Dominika closed her eyes and fought the nausea. The two women at her table were looking at her. "This was not something you see every day." They didn't know how right they were. Dominika looked up and saw swirling black. Sergei Maturin was sitting at the table across from hers, leaning over a bowl, spooning soup into his mouth. He was staring at her as he ate, his dead eye unblinking, just as a wolf watches even while drinking at a brook. SBR Cafeteria Chicken Kiev. Mix and chill compound butter with garlic, tarragon, lemon juice, and parsley. Pound chicken breast into wafer-thin cutlets. Roll tightly around thumb-sized pieces of compound butter. Tie with twine. Dust with seasoned flour, dip in egg wash, coat with breadcrumbs. Fry until golden brown. Chapter 6. Dominika entered the SVR's Academy of Foreign Intelligence, AVR, soon after her father's funeral. The school had been renamed several times during the Cold War, from the Higher Intelligence School to the Red Banner Institute to the AVR, but veterans simply called it School Number 101. The main campus for decades had been located north of Moscow, near the village of Chelyabitevo. By the time it became the AVR, the school had been modernized, the curriculum streamlined, admission criteria liberalized. The campus had moved to a clearing in the dense forests east of the city, at kilometer 25 on the Gorky Highway. It was therefore now referred to as Kilometer 25, or simply, the forest. In the early weeks, wary and excited, Dominika, the only woman, and a dozen new classmates were driven in rattling PAZ buses with darkly tinted windows to various locations around Moscow and the surrounding suburbs. They rolled through sliding metal gates into anonymous walled compounds registered as laboratories, research centers, or pioneer youth camps. The days were filled with lectures about the history of the services, of Russia, of the Cold War, and the Soviet Union. Whereas the chief attribute previously required for acceptance into former KGB schools was fealty to the Communist Party, the modern SVR required of its trainees an overarching devotion to the Russian Federation and a commitment to protect it from enemies within and without. For the first period of indoctrination, trainees were evaluated not only for aptitude but also for what in the old KGB would have been called political reliability. Dominika excelled in class discussions and written assignments. There was a hint of the independent streak in her of impatience with time-tested formulations and dicta. An instructor had written that Cadet Igorova would hesitate for just a second before answering a question as if she were considering whether she chose to answer, then invariably respond with excellence. Dominika knew what they wanted to hear. The slogans in the books and on the chalkboards were kaleidoscopes of color. They were easy to categorize and memorize. Tenets of duty, loyalty, and defense of the country. She was a candidate to become part of Russia's elite, the sword and shield of yesterday, the globe and star of today. Her youthful ideology had once horrified her free-thinking father. She knew that now, and she no longer totally accepted the ideology. Still, she wanted to do well. The start of the second training block. The class had moved permanently to the Kilometer 25 campus, a cluster of long, low buildings with pitch tile roofs, surrounded by pines and stands of birch. Sweeping lawns separated the buildings. Gravel paths led to the sports fields behind the buildings. The campus was a kilometer off the four-lane Gorkhovskoye Chaussee, screened first by a tall wooden palisade, painted green to blend in with the trees. Past this forest fence, 3 kilometers farther into the woods, ran 2 additional wire lines, between which black Belgian Malinois hounds ran free. The dog run could be seen from the windows of the small classrooms, and from their rooms in the 2-story barracks the students could hear the dogs panting at night. She was the only woman in the dormitory, and they gave her a single room at the end of the corridor. But she still had to share the bathroom and shower room with 12 men, which meant she had to find quiet times in the mornings and evenings. Most of her classmates were harmless enough, the privileged sons of important families, young men with connections to the Duma or to the armed forces or to the Kremlin. Some were bright, very bright, some were not. A few brave ones, used to getting what they wanted and seeing that silhouette behind the shower curtain, were ready to risk it all for a tumble. She had reached for her towel on the hook outside the shower stall in the gang bathroom late one night. It was gone. Then a knuckly classmate with sandy hair, the burly one from Novosibirsk, stepped into the stall with her, crowding behind her, his arms around her waist. She could feel he was naked as he pushed her face against the wall of the shower and nuzzled her wet hair from behind. He was whispering something she couldn't understand. She couldn't see the colors. He pressed up against her hard, and one hand drifted from around her waist to her breasts. As he squeezed her, she wondered if he could feel her heartbeat, if he could feel her breathing. Her cheek was pressed against the white tiles of the stall. She could feel them changing like prisms hung in sunlight. They were turning dark red. The tapered 3-inch faucet handle for the cold water had always been loose, and Dominika wiggled it back and forth until it came off in her hand. She turned, slippery and breathy, to face him, breasts now crushed against his chest, and said, "Stojat, wait a second," through a constricted throat. He was smiling as Dominika drove the pointed end of the faucet handle into his left eye up to her knuckle, and his vomit-green scream of pain and terror washed over her as he slid down the wall, clutching his face, his knees pulled up tight. "Stojat," she said again, looking down at him. "I asked you to wait a second." Attempted rape and justifiable self-defense was the secret AVR review board's judgment. A Novosibirsk gained a one-eyed bus conductor, and the board recommended that Dominika be separated from academy training. She told him that she had done nothing to cause the incident, and the panel, a woman and two men, looked her up and down and kept straight faces. They were going to do it to her again. Ballet school, Ustinov, now the AVR. And Dominika told the panel she would lodge a formal complaint. To whom would she complain? But word of the incident got back to Yasenyevo, and Deputy Director Igorov cursed so foully over the phone that Dominika would have seen brown treacle flowing out of the earpiece, and they told her the decision had been made to give her another chance under probationary status. From then on, the rest of her class ignored her, avoided her, a klikusha walking between the buildings and the forest. An impossibly straight back and long, elegant steps, with the faintest hitch in her stride. The start of the third block of AVR. They filed into classrooms with plastic chairs and pebbled acoustic tiles on the walls, and clunky projectors hanging from the ceiling. Dead flies lay in piles between the double window panes. Now came instruction in world economies, energy, politics, the third world, international affairs, and global problems. And America. No longer referred to as the main enemy, the United States nevertheless was her country's main competitor. It was all Russia could do to maintain superpower parity. Lectures on the subject took on an edge. The Americans took them for granted. They ignored Russia. They tried to manipulate Russia. Washington had interfered in recent elections, thankfully to no avail. America supported Russian dissidents and encouraged disruptive behavior in this delicate period of Russian reconstruction. American military forces challenged Russian sovereignty, from the Baltic to the Sea of Japan. The recent reset policy was an insult. Nothing needed to be reset. It was simply that Russia deserved respect. The Rodina deserved respect. Well, if, as an SVR officer, Dominika ever met an American, she would show him that Russia deserved respect. The irony was that America was in decline, said the lecturers, no longer the high and mighty U.S. Overextended in wars, struggling economically, the supposed birthplace of equality was now divided by class warfare and the poisonous politics of conflicting ideologies. And the foolish Americans didn't yet realize they would soon need Russia to hem in a galloping China. They would need Russia as an ally in the future war. But if Americans chose to pit themselves against Russia, thinking she was feeble and weak, they would be surprised. A student in the class disagreed. He suggested that yesterday's notions of East and West were antiquated. Besides, Russia had lost the Cold War. Get over it. There was a hush in the classroom. Another classmate stood, eyes flashing. Russia most certainly did not lose the Cold War, he said. It never ended. Dominika watched the scarlet letters ascend to the ceiling. Good words, strong words. Interesting. The Cold War never ended. Not long after, Dominika was separated from the rest of her class. She had no need for language instruction, for she could have been an instructor herself and spoken English or French, nor was she hustled off to the administrative track. Her instructors had seen her potential, had passed it on to AVR administrators who in turn had called Yasenyevo and requested the center's permission to admit Dominika Igorova, niece of the first deputy director, into the practical or operational phase of training. She would be the rare female candidate trained by the SVR as an operations officer. There were no delays. Approvals from the center had already been granted. She had been admitted to operations training, the real steel, the game. She had entered a special phase, the last chrysalis stage before she would emerge to serve the motherland. The time passed without her knowing it. Seasons seemed to change without her being aware of them. Classes, lectures, laboratories, interviews all came in a dizzying rush. It started with ridiculous subjects. Sabotage, explosives, infiltration, first taught when Stalin raved and the Wehrmacht encircled Moscow. Then came the more practical lessons, and they worked her hard. She developed legends, Zashifrovat, her cover for movement, ran routes to detect opposition surveillance on the street, found safe houses, transmitted secure messages, found meeting sites, Yavki, ran Vestrechki, agent meetings, plotted recruitment approaches. She practiced with disguises and digital communications, signals and caches. Her memory for detail, her lessons learned astounded them. Instructors in unarmed combat class were impressed by her strength and balance. They grew a little alarmed at her intensity and the way she wouldn't stay down on the mat after having been thrown. Everyone had heard the story from the forest, and the wide-eyed men in the class watched her hands and knees and protected their mudya when sparring with her. She saw their faces, saw the green breath of their disapproval and fear as they huffed and grunted in the gymnasium. No one came near her voluntarily. The practical instruction continued. They brought her to downtown Moscow, to the streets that were used as a living classroom, to practice tradecraft principles taught in the dingy classrooms around Yasenyevo. The streetcraft instructors were pensionerki, old spooks, some of them 70 years old, retired decades ago. They had some difficulty keeping up with Dominika as the exercises accelerated. They watched her bunched dancers' cabs striding along the shimmering Moscow sidewalks. The slight telltale limp from her shattered foot, now mended, was endearing. She was driven, determined to excel. Her face shone with perspiration. The sweat darkened her shirt between her breasts and across her ribs. The colors helped her on the street. The blues and greens from the teams and the radio cars and the watcher vans made it possible to pick out coverage among the crowds on broad boulevards. She twisted surveillance teams around themselves, meticulously timed brush passes on crowded metro platforms, met practice agents in dirty stairwells at midnight, controlled the meetings, read their minds. The old men would mop their faces and mutter, "Fanatichka," and she would laugh at them, her hair pulled back tight on her head, her shoulders straight, secretly reading the colors of their breathless approval. "Come on, dinosavri. Come on, you old dinosaurs." The gruff old men secretly loved her, and she knew it. These ancient instructors were supposed to coach her on what conditions would be like abroad, on what she could expect on the street, on how to operate in foreign capitals. Glupost, thought Dominika. What stupidity that these old men, who had last been overseas when Brezhnev ordered troops into Afghanistan, were telling her what to expect on the streets of modern-day London, New York, or Beijing. She had the temerity to mention the incongruity to a course coordinator who told her to shut her mouth and reported her comments up the line. Her face flushed at being spoken to that way, but she turned away, cursing herself. She was learning. As she was being evaluated, Dominika began courses on the psychology of intelligence collection, the psyche of sources, on understanding human motivations and identifying vulnerabilities. An instructor named Mikhail called it opening the human envelope. He was a 45-year-old SVR psychologist from the center. Dominika was his only student. He walked her around Moscow, both observing people, watching interactions. Dominika did not tell him about seeing colors, for her mother long ago had made her swear never to mention it. "And how in God's name do you know that about him?" Mikhail would ask when Dominika whispered that the man sitting on the next park bench was waiting for a woman. "It just seems that way," she would reply, never explaining that the bloom of passion purple around the man flared when the woman came around the corner. Mikhail laughed and looked at her in amazement when it turned out to be right. As Dominika focused on these practice sessions, her refined intuition told her she was having an effect on Mikhail. Even though he initially featured himself as a stern instructor from Directorate T, she would catch him looking at her hair or stealing darting glimpses at her body. She mentally counted the times he contrived to bump into her, or touch her on the shoulder, or put his hand on the small of her back when going through a door. He radiated desire. A dark crimson fog lingered around his head and shoulders. She knew how he liked his tea, when he needed his glasses to read a menu, the rate of his heartbeat when pushed close against her in the metro. She could see Mikhail stealing looks at her unpolished nails, or watching her dangle a shoe off her foot at the cafe table. It was a monstrous risk to sleep with him. He was an instructor and a psychologist to boot, charged with evaluating her personality and suitability for operations. Yet she knew he would say nothing. She knew she had an indefinable hold over him, and making love a grave dereliction during training was an edgy thrill, more than physical pleasure. Of which there was a considerable amount. An afternoon after a street exercise, they found themselves in the apartment Mikhail shared with his parents and brother, all at work or away from the house. The coverlet from his bed was on the floor, and her thighs trembled, and her shoulders shook, and her hair framed her face as she straddled him, pulses running up her spine and down to her toes, especially those of her once-broken foot. She knew what she wanted. Her secret self had been neglected of late, what with school and training and barracks. She trapped him, who was impaled upon whom, and rocked strongly downward, giving herself what she needed while she was still fresh. There would be time for softness and cooing and sighing later. Right now her eyes were half closed, and she concentrated on coaxing the building pressure stronger, stronger. Come on! Into the sudden teetering flush that made her double over, too sensitive to continue, too sweet to stop. Her vision cleared, and she brushed the hair off her face, aftershocks cramping her thighs and toes. Mikhail lay wide-eyed and silent beneath her, a bystander unsure of what he had just witnessed. Afterward, he kept taking sidelong glances at her while he made a pot of tea. Wrapped in a sweater and sitting at the kitchen table, Dominika guilelessly looked at him, and the psychologist and Mikhail simultaneously knew that the sex had nothing to do with him. He likewise knew he would say nothing about it, ever, and that they would never do it again. In a way, Mikhail was relieved. The operations course was coming to an end, the last leg of the tripod of training nearly complete. The exhausted pensioners who trained Dominika had long ago nicknamed her Mushka, beauty spot, also the colloquialism for the front sight of a gun, the sight that picks up the target first. Completing their evaluations, they positively assessed her industrious spirit. They remarked on her intellect and wit, and on her sometimes inexplicable intuitions on the street. Her loyalty and dedication to the Rodina were unquestioned. One or two pensioners noted that she was impatient. She could be argumentative. She needed to develop more flexibility in recruitment approaches. One old-timer alone wrote that despite her superior performance, he believed she lacked true patriotic zeal. Her natural independence eventually would unseat her devotion. It was a feeling, an impression. He could not cite any examples. The comment was discarded as the addled thought of an old fool. In any case, Dominika was never shown any of the evaluations. All that remained was a final practical exam on the street, using techniques honing her tradecraft. A final exercise, a written examination, an exit interview. She was almost through. Before any of that happened, however, and to the consternation of her instructors, Dominika disappeared from the course, summoned immediately to the center. Required for special duty, was all they said. Dominika was told to report to a room at the other end of the fourth floor of Yasenyevo, near the portraits of the directors. She knocked at a plain mahogany door and went inside. It was an executive dining room, small, wood-paneled, carpeted in deep wine red, windowless. Polished wood and antique sideboards gleamed in the recessed lighting. Uncle Vanya was seated at the far end of the dining table, covered by a snowy white tablecloth and set with Vinogradov porcelain. Crystal glasses twinkled in the light. He got up from his chair when he saw Dominika enter and walk down the length of the table to greet her with a vigorous hug around the shoulders. The graduate has come home. He beamed, holding her at arm's length. Top of your class, top marks on the street. I knew it. He put her arm in his and walked her down the room. There was another man sitting at the other side of the table, quietly smoking a cigarette. He looked to be 50 years old, with a red-veined tetrahedron for a nose. His eyes were dull and watery, his teeth corrugated and stained, and he slouched with the familiar casual authority honed on the razor strop of decades of Soviet officialdom. His tie was askew, his suit was a washed-out brown that recalled low tide at the beach. It matched the gaseous brown bubble that surrounded him as he sat. It was not the color, blacks and grays and browns assuredly were trouble. It was the paleness of the color and how it enveloped him in soft focus. He is bluzdayushi, devious, thought Dominika, not to be trusted. Dominika sat across from him, meeting his appraising stare with unblinking eyes. Vanya sat at his place at the head of the table, his paws folded demurely in front of him. Unlike the former Soviet apparatchik across from her, Vanya, as usual, wore an elegant pearl-gray suit, blue shirt with starched collar, and a navy tie with minute white dots. On his lapel he wore a small red ribbon with a sky-blue star, for merit to the fatherland. Zazaligi pered ochestvom, for significant contributions to the defense of the fatherland. Vanya lit a cigarette with a well-used silver lighter, which he snapped closed. "This is Colonel Semyonov," said Vanya, nodding in the direction of the slouching man. "He is the chief of the 5th Department." Semyonov said nothing, but leaned forward and flicked ash into a copper ashtray beside his plate. "We have identified a singular operational opportunity," continued Vanya. "The 5th has been given the responsibility to carry it out." Dominika looked from Vanya to Semyonov dully. "I have recommended to the colonel that you would be uniquely suited to assist in the operation, especially since you have completed your training at the academy with an excellent record. I wanted the two of you to meet." "What is this nonsense?" thought Dominika. "Thank you, General," she said. She took care not to call him uncle in the presence of a senior officer. "I still have 2 weeks to complete. There is a final exercise and the closing evaluations.
Your final evaluation is complete," interrupted Vanya. "There is no need to return to the AVR. In fact, I want you to begin additional training in preparation for this operational assignment with Semyonov." Vanya stubbed out his cigarette in an identical ashtray at his side. "May I ask the nature of the assignment, General?" said Dominika. She looked at the two impassive faces. They both were too smart to give anything away with a look, but they didn't know what else Dominika could see. Their respective bubbles swelled around their heads. "For now it is sufficient to tell you that this is a potentially important case, a conspiratia of some delicacy and sensitivity," said Vanya. "And the nature of the additional training?" asked Dominika. She kept her voice level, respectful. A door at the end of the room opened, and an orderly entered carrying a silver salver on a tray. "Lunch has arrived," said Vanya, sitting up. "Let us talk about the project after we eat." The waiter lifted the lid and began serving steaming golubtsi, large square cabbage rolls fried brown and swimming in a thick sauce of tomato puree and sour cream. "The best of Russian cooking," said Vanya, pouring red wine into Dominika's glass from a silver decanter. This was a charade. Dominika's newly trained operational antennae were buzzing. She had no appetite for the heavy food. Lunch lasted a dreary half hour. Semyonov uttered 3 words the entire time, though he continued to stare at Dominika from across the table. His expression was one of distinct boredom, with an air of not wanting to be in the room. Finished eating, he scrubbed his mouth with his napkin and pushed away from the table. "By your leave, General," he said. He gave Dominika another appraising look, nodded in her general direction, and left the room. "Let's have tea in my office," said Vanya, pushing back his chair. "We'll be more comfortable there." Dominika sat wearily upright on the couch in Vanya's office, the view of the Yasenyevo forest in front of them. Dominika was dressed in a white shirt and black skirt, her hair pinned up, the informal uniform at the academy. Two glasses of steaming tea in magnificent antique Kolchugino podstakanik tea glass holders sat on the table in front of them.
"Your father would be proud," said Vanya, sipping carefully.
"Thank you," said Dominika, waiting.
"I congratulate you on your achievement and on your entrance to the service."
"The training was challenging, but everything I could have hoped for," said Dominika. "I'm ready to start work." It was true. She soon would be on the front lines.
"It is always an honor to serve your country," he said, fingering the rosette on his lapel. "There is no greater honor."
He looked at his niece carefully.
"This operation with the Fifth, it's not something that comes along every day, especially not for a recent graduate." He sipped at his tea.
"I'm eager to learn more," said Dominika.
"Suffice to say that the operation is a recruitment approach to a foreign diplomat. It is of utmost importance that there be no exposure, no unmasking of the hand of the service. The diplomat must be compromised thoroughly and without a misstep."
His voice had grown thin, serious. Dominika said nothing, waiting for him to continue. She couldn't exactly see his words, they were indistinct and pale.
"Naturally, Colonel Semyonov expressed concern that your overall inexperience in operations, despite your excellent training record, could be a disadvantage. I assured him that my niece," he hung on to the word to indicate that he had exerted his influence, "was the perfect choice. He, of course, soon recognized the logic of using you, especially in light of the additional training I proposed."
Dominika waited. What office would they send her to? Technical measures, language, subject matter tutorial? Vanya lit a cigarette and blew smoke at the ceiling. "You have been enrolled in the specialized course at the Kohn Institute." Dominika willed herself to remain still, expressionless, coldly feeling the physical blow that started in her stomach and radiated up her back. People had whispered about the Institute during training. Formerly State School 4, more commonly referred to as Sparrow School, where men and women were trained in the art of espionage seduction. "You're sending me to whore school," she thought. "This is what they call Sparrow School?" she asked, controlling the quaver in her voice. "Uncle, I thought I would be entering the service as an officer, to be assigned to a department to begin practicing intelligence work. This is training for prostitutki, not staff officers." She felt she could hardly breathe. Vanya looked at her evenly.
"You must look at this interval positively. This training will reveal to you other options when you begin managing operations on your own in the future."
He sat farther back on the couch. "And the operation against the diplomat, do you intend that it should be a plovaya sobadnya? A honey trap?" She had read about the grimy sex operations while in the academy.
"The target is Zastyan Shivi, timid, shy. We have assessed his vulnerabilities over many months. Colonel Semyonov agrees that he is susceptible."
Dominika stiffened. "The colonel knows about what you want me to do, about Sparrow School?" She shook her head. "He was staring at me across the table. He might as well have opened my mouth and checked my teeth." Vanya interrupted, his voice now a little edgy.
"I'm sure he was very impressed. He is a veteran officer. And all operations are unique in their own ways. There has been no final decision made as yet on how to proceed. Nevertheless, this is an immense opportunity for you, Dominika."
"I cannot do this," Dominika said. "After the previous operation, how it ended, it took me months to forget Ustinov's..."
"You're bringing that up? Didn't you remember my instructions to you to forget that episode, to never refer to it?" Vanya said. "I require absolute compliance in that regard."
"I have never uttered a word," Dominika snapped back. "It's just that if this is another of those operations, I'd rather..."
"You'd rather. You are a graduate of the academy and a junior officer in the service now. You will obey orders, accept assignments given to you, and do your duty. You will defend the Rodina."
"I am committed to serving Russia," said Dominika. "It's just that I object to being used in these sorts of operations. There are people who do this work regularly. I have heard about them. Why not use one of them?" Vanya frowned. Stop talking. Not another word. You don't have the sense to see what I'm offering you. You're thinking about yourself, about your childish preoccupations. As an SVR officer, you have no preferences, no choices. You accomplish what you are told to do with excellence. If you choose not to accept, to allow your frantic prejudices to derail your career before it begins, tell me now. We will release you from the service, close your file, cancel your pension, and withdraw your privileges. All of them. How many times will my mother's neck be put into the noose, thought Dominika. What else would they make her do to let her serve with honor? Vanya saw her shoulders slump. Very well, she said, rising. With your permission, may I go? Dominika got up and walked in front of the picture window toward the door, the sun highlighting her hair, framing her classic profile. Vanya watched her walk across the carpet. Did she limp a little? And stopped briefly at the door to turn and look back at him. A shiver ran over his scalp as he saw the blue eyes intense and unblinking, ripsaws and scalpels fix on his face for 3 alarming seconds. Glowing like wolves' eyes just beyond the lights of the Blizhnya, the dacha. He had never seen a look like that in his life. Before he could say anything else, she was gone, like a klikusha in the Krasny Bor forest. SVR Golubtsi. Blanch cabbage leaves, cook rice. Saute chopped onions, carrots, and peeled and seeded tomatoes until soft. Incorporate with the rice and ground beef. Fold cabbage leaves around 2 spoons of mixture to form large square envelopes. Fry in butter until brown, then simmer for 1 hour in stock, tomato sauce, and bay leaves. Serve with reduced sauce and sour cream. Chapter 7. Nate Nash arrived at Helsinki-Vantaa Airport after a 2-hour flight. The modern airport was sparkling and well-lit. Like at Sheremetyevo, there were flashy advertisements for cologne, watches, and vacation trips. Airport shops stocked with lingerie, gourmet food items, and magazines stretched down the airy terminal. But the lingering smell of cooked cabbage, rosewater cologne, and wet wool was missing. Instead, cinnamon buns were baking somewhere. As Nate collected his single suitcase, cleared customs, and headed to the taxi stand outside, he did not see a short man in a plain dark suit watching him from across the arrival hall. This man spoke briefly into a cell phone and turned away. In 30 minutes, 900 kilometers to the east, Vanya Igorov knew that Nash had arrived in Finland. The game would begin. The next morning, Nate walked into the office of Tom Forsyth, chief of station in Helsinki. Forsyth's office was small but comfortable, with a single nautical painting hanging above his desk and a small couch against the opposite wall. A framed photo of a sailboat on a glassy ocean stood on a table beside the couch, with another framed photo of what appeared to be a youthful Forsyth at the wheel beside it. Shades in the office were drawn over a single window. Forsyth was tall and lean, in his late 40s, with receding gray hair and a strong chin. Intense brown eyes looked up at Nate over the top of half-moon glasses. Forsyth smiled, threw a sheaf of papers into an inbox, and got up to shake hands from across the desk. His handshake was firm and dry. "Nate Nash," he said with a smooth voice. "Welcome to station." He gestured for Nate to sit in a leather chair in front of his desk. "Thanks, Chief," said Nate. "You in an apartment? Where did the embassy put you?" asked Forsyth. The embassy housing office had that morning deposited him in a comfortable 2-bedroom flat in Kruununaka. Nate had been delighted when opening the double doors to a small balcony with a view of the marina, the ferry terminal, and the sea beyond, and he told Forsyth so. "That's a nice area, an easy walk to work," said Forsyth. "I'd like you to huddle with me and Marty Gable to get an idea of what we've got going." Gable was the deputy chief of station, whom Nate had not met yet. "We've got a couple of good cases, but there's more we can do. Forget about the internal target. The Finns are allies, and we've got them covered. Marty and I will work liaison, so you don't have to worry about the internal service. We'll pass along any unilateral possibilities that we develop. All the usual Arabs, Hezbollah, Hamas, Palestinians, they've all got reps in town. Might be tricky getting close to them, so think about access agents. Iranians, Syrians, Chinese, small embassies, and they feel safe here in neutral Scandinavia. The Persians might be looking for embargoed equipment. Check them out on the dip circuit," Forsyth said, tilting back in his office chair. "I want to go after something bigger," said Nate. "I have to score big after what happened to me in Moscow." "Indeed," thought Forsyth. He saw worry behind the eyes, determination in the set of the jaw. Nate sat upright in his chair. "That's fine, Nate," said Forsyth. "But any recruitment, as long as it's productive, is a good recruitment. And you land the big fish by being patient, by working the circuit, by generating a dozen developmental contacts." "I know that, Chief," said Nate quickly. "But I don't have the luxury of time. That Gondorf is gunning for me. If it weren't for you, I'd be back in Russian ops in front of a computer pushing a mouse. I never told you how much I appreciate your asking for me." Forsyth had read Nate's personnel file, sent out to station when Nate's lateral assignment had been approved. Not many young case officers with nearly fluent Russian. Top marks throughout training at the farm, and subsequently in denied area training for Moscow, the art of operating under constant hostile surveillance. The file also positively noted Nate's performance in Russia, especially his handling of a sensitive restricted case. No details. But Forsyth now saw a distracted young case officer squirming in front of him, with something to prove. "Not good. Makes you accident-prone, always swinging for the fences with your eyes closed. I don't want you worrying about Moscow. I talked to some people in headquarters and you're fine." He saw Nate's face working at the thought of his hall file. "And I want you to listen to me," said Forsyth. He stopped until he had Nate's attention. "I want you to work smart, good tradecraft, no shortcuts. We all want the big cases. Hell, you're handling one now. But I won't accept half-assed operations. Clear?" Forsyth looked hard at Nate. "Clear?" he repeated. "Yes, sir," said Nate. He got the message, but told himself he was going to find agents. He wasn't going to flame out as a case officer. He was not going home. He flashed a crazy quilt images of him in a Richmond country club sitting across from Sue Ann or Mindy, bee-stung lips and frosted hair piled high, as his brothers putted golf balls across the tartan plaid rug into one of Missy's pink Lily Pulitzer flats lying on the rug across the club room. Fuck no. "Okay," said Forsyth. "Find your desk. Be the first office down the hallway. Get out of here and go find Gable," he said, reaching for his inbox. DCOS Marty Gable was sitting in his terminal in another small office one door down from Forsyth's, trying to figure out how to write a cable to headquarters without using the word cocksucker. Older than Forsyth, Gable was in his late 50s, big and broad-shouldered with white brush-cut hair, blue eyes, and a steel girder for a nose. His forehead was tanned and ruddy, the weather-beaten face of an outdoorsman. Knuckly brown hands dwarfed his keyboard immobile. He hated drafting cables, hated typing with two fingers, hated the bureaucracy. He was a street guy. Nate stood in the doorway of his office. It was totally bare, unadorned, save for a government-issue picture of the Washington Monument on the wall. His desktop was empty. Before Nate could knock courteously on the doorframe, Gable swiveled in his chair and looked at Nate with a scowl. "You the new guy? Cash?" bawled Gable. The accent was somewhere from the Rust Belt. "Nash, Nate Nash," said Nate as he walked to the desk. Gable remained sitting but extended his frying pan hand. Nate tensed for the inevitable bone-crushing grip. You took your time getting here. You recruit anyone on the way and from the airport? Gable laughed. No? Well, there's time after lunch, he said. Let's go. On the way out of